I am calling to order this meeting of the aptly named Early Childhood Committee, because it is feeling very early and cold, calling us to order. And we're going to start by having the clerk take the roll, and then we'll do some business.
Representative Pinto, Chair.
Present.
Representative Katiza Watoon, Vice Chair.
Present.
Representative Franson. Representative Bonner. Representative Damick.
Present.
Representative Heintzman. Present. Representative Morrison.
Present.
Representative Pryor.
Present.
Representative Wasilek.
Present.
Representative West.
Here.
Excellent. And we do have a quorum. Let's get, you have several copies of minutes in your folders, members. What we need to do is we'll get the March 28th, 2019 minutes approved. The other ones are unofficial as of yet, and so I think we need to do a few things relating to them. But the March 28th, 2019 minutes, if I can have a motion to approve those.
So moved.
Okay, Representative Pryor approves, moves for approval of the March 28th, 2019 minutes. Any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor of approval of those minutes, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay, we've approved those minutes. The other 2 minutes relate to our 2 meetings that we had during the interim, and I want to thank members especially for their attendance, that we had actually attendance from every single member of the committee a week and a half ago to discuss the impact of incarceration on young kids and families, and I thought that was a really powerful discussion. If folks who are watching this either in the room or on remotely didn't get a chance to see that hearing, I really would encourage you to do so, because there was some really powerful discussion. I posted something on social media about it and had some folks who said, research shows that when a child has an incarcerated parent, there's a negative impact. And people said, essentially, thank you, Captain Obvious. Of course that'd be true. And yet, what we got into was some really, I think, powerful data about that negative impact and some steps that we can take together to address that impact. And I found especially the comments of Bill Hutton, the executive director of the Sheriff's Association, talking about when he was sheriff and not thinking about the impact of this, of having parents in his jail in his county, and how to facilitate contact with the kids and try to mitigate those negative impacts. It was really powerful. So thank you, members, for that. And then for our hearing at the mini session in October, talking about the child care crisis and the opportunity gaps, continuing our partnership with the Jobs and Economic Development Committee, but we've had with a couple of hearings around the state on those issues. And that was, I thought, really powerful as well. So a couple of other bits of business before we get to our main event here. We do have some new staff members. We are joined by a new committee administrator sitting to my right, Alyssa Fritz. And I just want to highlight for folks that she comes with a strong HHS background, having been the previous committee legislative assistant for the HHS Policy Committee and has a master's in public health, but then also has a strong education background. She's the CA for the Education Policy Committee. So in the two parent committees for our division, we've got a nice strong background there. And then we're joined by Annie Mock, who's the new House Research Analyst for our area and comes from the Congressional Research Service most previously, and so glad to have Annie here as well. Otherwise, I think that our staff is pretty much the same, and we're so grateful to all of you for your work. Let me think. And then I want to highlight for folks, and I'm pretty sure the members have a copy of this. I don't know if it's in the public packet. We'll make sure to post it. But there's a memo from House Research about the different ways that bills will be moving this session. As part of the resolution of the 2019 session, there was an agreement to make a change so that divisions that are under Ways and Means, bills will stop moving between them via memo as they had been last session and had in previous sessions too at various points, but now be moving to and from the floor via Ways and Means. It's laid out in here, and again, we'll make sure to post this as well for the public. One thing to note about that is that bills that were referred to divisions previously via memo have to go back out via memo. So many of the bills in our possession, including House File 1, which we'll talk about in a minute, got to our division via memo. They're going to have to go back out via memo to Ways and Means, then to the floor and out from there. And hopefully we get all that figured out. And if folks have questions, I can give it a try, but you may want to direct to House Research as well. I should just pause. Any questions so far about the things that have been discussed from anybody? Not seeing any. And then finally, I think this last piece before we get into the meat of it here is the reference thing to House File 1 and just our plan for the next week and a half. So Today we're going to be discussing the child care assistance program, and it should be a good discussion. And then next week we plan to take up, you'll recall that House File 1 was introduced last year. We'll be posting an amended version of that bill and plan to have a presentation on that on Tuesday. Public testimony may possibly begin even that Tuesday evening, because I want to highlight for members in the public, we're going to be together Tuesday morning, but we have given notice that we'll be reconvening on Tuesday evening. I think we planned at 5:30. And then the plan would be public, any public input that folks wish to provide on that bill, and then would expect to have a vote then most likely Tuesday the 25th. I guess it's possible if we finish things quickly enough, we maybe would do that even yet the morning of Thursday the 20th. There is some of the content. House File 3071 was pre-filed, and that contains some of that as well. But then, as I said, we'll be posting it and should give members plenty of time and the public as well to peruse it, ask questions, and work through things as well. And then we'll continue on with other hearings after that. Any questions that members have before we get into the discussion here on the topic? And not seeing any, so we'll do that. So I'd like to then, in that case, let me just make sure, I think we're all set. So let's bring up our testifiers, if we can. And I'll just set this up, Commissioner Johnson and Mr. Swanson, just set this up by noting that last session, we can be really proud that we made a number of changes to the oversight of the Child Care Assistance Program. We, as a group, analyzed the situation very carefully, proposed a number of steps, and I'm delighted to say that almost everything that we had advanced through our committee and then through the body was, in fact, adopted into law. May have been a couple things that got stopped by the Senate, but we managed to get almost all of it through. And I thought it'd be a really good way to start off the session to hear about how those changes have been working out. And I know the department themselves, we can see by these big posters on either side, the department itself had done some work at looking at how to continuously improve this program as well. It even started even before we passed those changes. So glad to have our testifiers here. I think we're going to start with Commissioner Johnson and then move to Mr. Swanson, et cetera. Commissioner, if you can identify yourself for the record, and please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good morning, members. My name is Chuck Johnson. I serve as Deputy Commissioner at the Department of Human Services. Thank you for the opportunity to be here to talk about the progress that we've made over the last year at strengthening the Child Care Assistance Program. As we all know, child care assistance is a critically important service for low-income families across Minnesota. Both provides early childhood opportunities for children and also provides support for working parents. Child care is expensive. When low-income parents, working parents, don't have child care, that often results in unsafe situations for children or parents who aren't able to maximize their earnings in the marketplace. It's a critically important program. As with any program that we administer with significant expenditures, it's also important that we have strong program integrity and strong oversight of the program. Over the last year, we've been working to strengthen the oversight and integrity of the program. We're going to talk to you about that on two fronts that we've been working on today. First, the continuous improvement project that's focused on the conduct, the processes, the policies around how we do child care fraud investigations. And then secondly, as Chair Pinto noted, the implementation of the legislation, real robust package of legislative measures that were passed last year to support integrity and oversight of the program. So we'll start with the CI process. Mr. Swanson is here with me. Jeff Swanson is the Director of the Management Services Division for DHS. He also serves as the Director of our Office of Continuous Improvement. That's an office that's worked across DHS over the last 7 or 8 years, helping us to resolve a number of issues, straighten out processes, make us more efficient. But it's also the group that went over to the Department of Health in 2018 when there were all the issues around elder abuse investigations, and worked with the Office of Health Facility Complaints to help improve that process and fix those problems. So the very experienced group that brings a lot of value to the table. Jeff will walk you through the continuous improvement process. You'll note as he's talking some of the issues, some of the measures that you passed last year are already tools that we are leveraging within that process, and you'll see that good work has already paid off. Then after that, I will walk through those measures in a little bit more detail and try to cover some of the ones that Jeff may have not mentioned as part of his presentation. So you have a full status of where we are at implementing the legislation from 2019. I hope after hearing this, you'll realize that we're on a good path to strengthen the child care assistance program going forward, the integrity and the oversight of the program to make it an effective program for children and families. With that, I'll turn it over to Jeff.
Thank you, Commissioner. And before we turn things over, I just want to highlight for members and the members of the public this one-pager kind of blue and green that I think contains some really helpful information about what's being discussed. So the side that's more has the blue header, looks like it focuses on the continuous improvement project, and the green header focusing more on the 2019 changes. And so with that, Mr. Swanson, please identify yourself for the record and please proceed.
Thank you, Chairman Pinto. My name is Jeff Swanson, the Director of Management Services Division, and as Deputy Commissioner Johnson said, I also lead the Office of Continuous Improvement for DHS. I am so thankful to be here this morning to tell you about the great news that the Department and OIG has done over the last year. And as Deputy Commissioner Johnson mentioned, how this really dovetails in nicely to the legislation that was passed last year. I think we mentioned last time we chatted, Chairman, that it was almost like a hand in glove. We don't always have that with legislation, but it was perfect timing to kind of bring that into play while we were creating the new design of the new process. So thanks again. We have two large props for you guys to see. You should have copies of these with you. The one little difference that you have with your copies is that you'll see that they have circles with numbers, I believe five on each one. That'll help us guide as I talk about this legacy process and as we talk about the current process. So hopefully it'll be straightforward as we go through it. I'm going to start with the legacy process, but we're not going to spend a lot of time on that. That was kind of rehashed over the last year, and we have some significant improvements. But I think it's important to understand where we were and where we're going is critical. So to my right is a lengthy process. When we testified with the Senate at a committee get-together in October, we coined a phrase that was used earlier, bureaucratic barnacles. You see a lot of bureaucratic barnacles on the workflow to the right. It's fair to say that that process was focused very heavily in focusing on the criminal conviction side of the process, and we did not take advantage of the administrative tools that we had at the time, and it was very focused in a one-dimensional way. It's fair to say that this process is more one- and two-dimensional. When we get to the newer improved process, you'll see more of a three-dimensional view of how to approach these issues. We had a real lack of standards, protocols, and decision-making matrix in regards to this legacy process. It was built in such a way over years of, and when we call it bureaucratic barnacles, just for clarification, we use that because it's very synonymous to what happens in bureaucracy, right? You get years and years of policy, legislation, internal work rules, building up. A few barnacles attached is nothing more than a nuisance. It's like mosquitoes. When you get a lot of barnacles attached, that's when it can really be disruptive to the process and the program. And that's what we experienced when we worked with the CCAP and OIG back of January of last year. There was multiple sources of data in this legacy system. People had files in file cabinets, boxes, drawers, shared drives, home drives. So that was one of the frustrations I know the legislative body had last year with the lack of getting data that was repeatable and was accurate and timely. We watched a lot of those sessions. It was painful for us to have to experience from the agency side of view. So that was one thing we wanted to tackle very early on in this process, is to make sure that we have a number, and we'll be sharing some of them today, that we know are repeatable and they are accurate and they are ready for prime time. The real issue here on the legacy process is the whole concept of Lean and Lean Six Sigma is to have value added, right, to get rid of all non-value added tasks. And this is a good example of the seven non-value added types of waste. This process had five of them. I mean, it was really, really inundated with bureaucratic protocols in a lot of cases that were not adding to the final resolution of issues or making the business case. So that's one thing we had to really look at is how do we really redo this in such a way. So it started out as an improvement process, but just like when you have some projects and you almost have to start afresh, this was very much a design process. So we started out as an improvement manner, and then we thought with the new legislation that was coming our way, this would be a great opportunity to design something fresh that meets the critical to quality that everybody had on that. The process really hindered productivity. The average investigation caseload for the investigators were 1.5 cases. That was what they were averaging. And it wasn't because of their lack of trying. It was because of this process. The team really was passionate about doing good for this state and the children. The problem is this bureaucratic process really got in the way of that. And I'm glad to say we're going to be able to share with you a number that's much more impressive. At 1.5. So it wasn't their lack of trying or their lack of effort. It was simply the bureaucratic process got in the way. Dr. Deming, the father of continuous improvement, has a saying that a bad process will beat a good person every time. This is a great example of it. It would be impossible to do really some good government based upon that process that was in place, the legacy process. So if anybody has any questions, I don't know, Chairman, how you want to handle that, but
thanks. I'm thinking, why don't you move on to the new process, because that's or the current process, I guess I should say, and then we'll kind of see as folks go on. Yeah, thank you.
So thank you. This is what I am very excited about and what our team is excited about as well. I have my pointer, so I get to use it, so I'm all excited on this. So to give you a sense, this is a high-level flow of what the new process is moving forward. And as your handout has, we will correlate that with the information, with the talking points that we'll be using. So I'll be correlating to the numbers. I believe we have five areas we're going to focus on. The first one up here I'd like to talk about is how our intake process has changed. Is it okay with the mic if I turn, or does it not pick me up? Or
It probably won't pick up real well. Okay. I don't know if we have some way to do that otherwise, I'm afraid. So you may need to sort of just kind of keep on turning the mic.
Okay.
We'll see if we can come up with something else. Okay. But we do need to make sure you get captured, so, yeah,
okay.
On the mic.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So this area here, the intake process, is an area that we do intake and triage. It's a new feature. It's fair to say we did not do the greatest job in capturing data under the legacy process and information. So any tip, whether acted upon or not, will actually be registered. So we will actually be able to have a history of that, what happened when, so that we can build data. We can build actionable data and information moving forward. So we are going to capture all of those. So, for example, since July 1st of last year to the end of January this year, we've had 57, I want to get that right, 57 triage reports that have come through the process that refers to possible program integrity issues. So we've had 57 of them since July 1st. When in doubt, the time frame that I'm talking about moving forward will be July 1st, 2019 through January 2020. So that's kind of the mode here we have, and we want to be very conscious of this data, so we want to make sure we give you the right time frame that it was in. So we had 57 that came through. That really came through three ways. If you look on your handout, it comes through the early and often team, and the early and often team is truly what it says. It's a plan by licensing an OIG to get out to the providers as quickly as possible and as often as needed. And this was legislation that you had last year and funding that as well. So this is where we are putting them to work. And that is one of the ways that we get information into our triage. The other way is doing a data analysis, where we actually are using some of the resources that have been provided to us to actually go in and do data analysis and pulling together different systems, different subsets in that direction. So that's the other area. And then, of course, we have the OIG hotline for the general public to call in tips when they see something that is not proper in their opinion. Now, I'm going to give you another number that quickly you're going to go perceive that it's a little bit offsetting from the 57 that I told you about earlier. But we currently have 63 investigations that are going on since July 1st, right, 2019 and January 2020. So we had 57 tips. We have 63 investigations. The reason that is some of the tips that generated these investigations happened prior to July 1st. So they happened in June. That's why this number is larger than the tips that we received. So 63. We then have a process called first assessment. If you look at the circle number 2, you'll see a first assessment feature. That is where we have we brought together a cross-functional team made up of subject matter experts from licensing, legal, and the data team. And the purpose here is to use standard documented practices to do and take into effect the preliminary investigation that was done by triage, and then get a full picture, a summary, a comprehensive summary of data points from multiple DHS systems. And then they research that per center. So this gets back to our one-dimensional, two-dimensional, getting to that three-dimensional view of the center and the issues that might be related. To give you another data point, one of the things that can happen at first assessment is if the team decides it's warranted, warning letters can be issued. The department has issued 20 warning letters from July 1st, 2019 through January 2020. These are 20 warning letters, and they have been issued to providers with minor violations. And this is data we couldn't have gave you a year ago just on how we did our business. So this is new to this process. If we focus on area 3 of the handout regarding early and often in the investigation, as I referenced before on the legacy process, it was really one-dimensional. We had the criminal path, and that was the one that was predominantly used. We have now two investigative approaches we can use. The first one is that early and often team, and that's made up of a licensor and a CCAP investigator going out as needed on site to collect records, use their firsthand knowledge to assess policy violations, licensing violations, and potential misconduct. So they go out as a team, part of that early often, to get there earlier. One of the things that was a byproduct of the legacy process was that while the criminal investigations were going on, to use a term, the water was still left on. There was an issue that payments were being made. Then, unfortunately, the agency got into that situation of pay and chase, where we have to recover the funds afterwards. And the numbers are not very impressive on our results of doing that. So it's so important to shut that water off early in the process. And that's really what we're getting to with the new and the existing process here, is that a lot of these key decisions that were made actually too late in the process here are brought up earlier in the process. So we take the appropriate action based upon units collaborating and knocking down the silos within OIG to make sure we have a clear picture and take the appropriate action at the appropriate time. So the first option is that early and often, as we talked about. The second option we have, if it's warranted, it's a CCAP FFAID investigators. Based upon the nature of the case, we'll do a deeper dive, maybe use tools such as video surveillance, subpoenas, interviews, if that is warranted based upon that preliminary investigation. And then number 4 on the list is the Second Amendment, number 4 on that area. And that talks about the cross-functional team. Remember, we have multiple sets of eyes and multiple units looking at these, so we get a different perspective than we had before. And that one is tied where the cross-functional teams come together through document strategies, and we can take various administrative actions. One of those actions are overpayments assessed. And this is a number I believe I promised you, Representative West. So it is approximately $600,000 These are funds that the agency is looking at assessing for overpayments, and that was between July 1st and January. Also, we have had two termination of registrations for two CCAP providers under statute 245E. We've also had two closed registrations for two CCAP providers, and those were closed with payments immediately suspended due to fraud investigation and with evidence of intent, and that's under statute 119B. We've also had four administrative disqualifications. Of those four, to non-compliant providers, two of these are subject to pending appeal. So of the actions that were taken, what I just went through was a direct correlation to the resources and the ability that you gave us last year to enhance our ability to mitigate some of the risks that we had. There's always some concern that have we went too far with the pendulum, the balance going from all criminal, now there's a fear that we're going all administrative. That's not the case. We have a balanced approach. Since July 1st, 2019 through January, we've had 12 cases that have been referred for criminal investigation since implementation of this new process. Now, we cannot publicly discuss those. All I can say is that in the past, predominantly a majority of those have went to the BCA. So that just shows the balanced approach. You see the administrative sanctions that go into place, and then you also have the criminal component when warranted. Since during the time of this process, July through January, we've had two criminal convictions. One has resulted in the closing of the center, based upon that. We talked a little bit about the legacy plan here in regards to that 1.5 was a case average for the investigators. Under this process, that number is 8.8 cases per investigator. That's an increase of 450%. So, and also just to caution people, we never sacrifice quality when we do the CI events and we look at reengineering. Quality is always a given. Speed is something that we can enhance, of course, as we move on, but quality is a given. So we never sacrifice quality for speed. I know that was a concern for some representatives and some senators. I can assure you that's not the case on that. Just on some closing thoughts about this system and this new current process that we're living in, we actually have the ability to do reporting at every data point in your flow. So if you notice, you see the purple box that has case management database, Agile apps. At every location you see that, every part of that is data fields that we're going to be able to report on and do some more aggressive data mining in the future in regards to trending and other things like that. So that's exciting for us. Also, we're kind of growing into this process. It's new, it's stable, it's working, but we're kind of growing into it. So it becomes some muscle memory, some maturity of the process. So that is an area that we will be working on. All the key performance indicators from the continuous point of view, continuous improvement point of view, are all projecting in the right direction. People are becoming more familiar with it, more at ease with it. Defects are dropping, mistakes are not as frequent. So we are seeing good, healthy acceptance of the program.
Mr. Swanson, let me pause you. I'm not sure if you're, are you done with your presentation?
Yeah, I wanted to leave plenty of time for questions.
Okay, good. So I know, and I'm generally inclined to do some clarification questions and then have the commissioner present and then do a broader discussion. I know Representative Heintzman had a question, though, and I'm sorry, Representative Heintzman, that I think we were confused about whether you had had one or not earlier, so my apologies. Representative Heintzman.
No, I appreciate that, Mr. Chair. I did have questions, but I wanted to wait until presentation was over in case he covered that.
Okay, good. Good.
Right.
So then Representative Franson does this. Oh, so you take them at the end. Is that what you're saying?
Are we at the end? If we are,
it sounds like we're at the end of Mr. Swanson's. I think if there's clarification about Mr. Swanson's presentation, we can definitely do that. My thinking was that it might make sense if there's broader discussion to hear from the commissioner as well and then do the broader discussion. But there may be, but it, certainly if there's some questions about the details Mr. Swanson covered, we can do that too. And then I'll turn to, so Representative Heintzman, anything from you right now or do you want, yes? Okay.
Thank you, Mr.
Chair. Sure, Representative Heisman, sure.
You know, first of all, I guess I'd really like to thank you, Mr. Chair, lead with something positive that we're talking about this today, the first day of our meeting this session. If I remember correctly, it was a dozen meetings before we heard from a commissioner relative to fraud at DHS the last year, and that we're coming right out of the gate talking about this is encouraging to me. My questions, Director Swanson, are somewhat centered around this new process that we're describing, and I mean, I'm sure you understand this, and there's lots of folks at home that are listening, and I'll just tell you what I'm hearing from them. Okay. Whenever there's a problem at an agency, it's the process. And now we have a new process, and I mean, we'd all like to believe that this new process is going to be that much better than the old process, and 400% increase in folks that are conducting able to conduct an investigation. That's great. But really, what assurances are there that this new process is going to be that much better than the old one?
If I can just and pause for 1 second, so because I do want to note that this process, Representative Heisen, just to remind you, is built within a broader set of changes as well. So I wonder if it might make sense for us to hear about all the changes and then to get the sense from the department in answer to your question. Because this is one piece, this continuous improvement piece, but we do know that there's many other changes that we're going to be hearing about this morning. So I wonder if it makes sense to get back to your question once we hear about all the changes, if you understand what I'm saying.
Mr. Chair, more specifically, I'm wondering what checks and balances there are in the changes that have been discussed just in the last few minutes so that we know that we're actually getting at fraud. So maybe he could address that now, because I think that if we just continue to talk about changes, that doesn't necessarily address my question of checks and balances so that, you know, the people of Minnesota know that we're getting at this problem.
Representative Heisman, my only thought about that, though, is doesn't it make sense to first hear about all the changes and then to get to your question answered about checks and balances rather than hearing about some changes, because it seems like it's sort of we're missing a piece then, if that makes sense. We should hear about all the changes, and then, of course, certainly we should hear from the department about the checks and balances. I just fear that then we're hearing about one piece rather than, I mean, shouldn't we sort of hear about all the changes first? I guess would be what I'd be inclined, because I guess that doesn't seem like a clarification about this individual, about understanding this. It seems like there's more, because there's a whole other set of changes. Maybe if we can defer your question to first hear about all the changes, and then let's definitely, and have you go first, please, out of the gate from that, about, you know, to have the department respond. I just fear that this is only one piece, and we know there's a number of other changes as well.
Just to be clear, Mr. Chair, that's why I asked if we were at the end of the presentation a few minutes ago, and now it sounds like you're telling me we're not at the end of the presentation.
Well, as I said before, so we've got the second half of this to hear from the commissioner about the changes that were passed into law and find out what that's about. So I was saying if there was some clarification to understand some of the details here. My apologies if that seemed to be confusing.
Chair, could I restate my question?
Of course, Representative.
Sure. Maybe if Director Swanson could tell me what checks and balances are in place relative to the process you just described right here at this time.
Thank you, Mr. Swanson. Thank you, Representative.
Chairman Pinto, Representative, I'd be happy to do that. Part of these presentations that are so difficult when we talk about Lean Six Sigma is we can do it at different levels, right? We can get into the weeds. Every one of these plans has something called a control plan. Every process we put into place has a control plan, which leads to sustainability. I believe some of the areas you were probably focusing on is how do we make sure we don't get into that again, maybe? And the control plan would definitely do that. It forces the supervisors and the managers to be accountable working with their team, and there's operational data. So the data is not consistent where twice a year we run reports for you guys. The data truly is something that's going to be ran weekly, if not some organizations in our agency does it daily, that we will actually stay on top of it to that level. So that is, what decision is being made? What was the logic behind it? What was the law behind it? And are we getting the outcomes we said we're going to? That's why this whole data, how we look at it, is to get the information back on, were we successful, were we not? Are we going through too many appeals, are we not? All that stuff is gonna go into the data modeling moving forward. So the control plan is management's responsibility to stay on top of this process.
Representative Heisman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just to follow up on that, Director, we have an OLA report that we looked at very closely last session that Commissioner Johnson, to his credit, came and talked to us about. One of the frustrating things as legislators is that there was no real opportunity for the OLA to come in and see the kind of information that could give us conclusive data one way or the other, how fraud was occurring, how frequent fraud was occurring. There was still a lot of question marks. In other words, I'm asking, if it's not going to be the OLA, who is it going to be that's accountable? Because when we go back home to our districts, people aren't saying, well, what process did you fix today? They're wondering who is working on this and who is responsible to make sure there's a check and balance. Yep. And so who would be held accountable if there was a failure in this system or in this process?
Mr. Swanson.
Chairman Pinto, Representative, I believe that's where this legacy process you see right here was almost impossible for somebody to be successful in. To Dr. Deming's point, a bad process will beat a good person, it'll beat a good manager, it'll beat a good agency. This process was not sustainable in a positive sense for that return that you're looking at or for. So all I can tell you is that we focus on the process. Normally the process triggers some of the organizational movements that you see occasionally, but we just focus on the process so that employees have the ability to get a fair chance to do good work, which they did, and so it's meaningful. I appreciate your question, but we solely focus on the process, not the organizational or the management issues and things like that.
And maybe Representative Heitzman, that once we hear from the commissioner, that'll be a good question to direct to him as well, if that makes sense. Anything further on clarification right now, Representative Heisman? No, okay. Representative Franson, do you want to ask something right now? Wait as well, okay. And so, Commissioner, I might ask you to make sure to go through relatively quickly, because I know there's a lot of interest in some bigger, broader questions from members as well. So thank you, Mr. Swanson, and Commissioner, then if we can go back to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to be, if you look at the handout you have, there's a side of it that has a green top on it. This is actually shows you the legislative changes that were passed last year on the left-hand side, and on the right-hand side shows you the current status of implementation for the agency. And I just call out down the middle, you see these five buckets that are called out. I think this really goes to how comprehensive the package was last year to really try to address each of the elements of concerns that were raised through the audits, through our own internal identification of issues that needed to be addressed as part of the legislative action last year. So at the top, we have record keeping. You'll recall that attendance records are a really key part of doing fraud investigations on child care programs, understanding what the records say about who was actually attending in a given day, how long they were there, and so forth. So there are a number of changes that were made there in terms of ensuring that we are getting attendance records immediately upon going out to a provider, ensuring some clarifications around absent days and holidays and decreases in attendance that were used sometimes and manipulated by providers. So we would get a set of records that would then change and say, well, that was an absent day. We clean that up so we have stronger controls around how those records have to be kept. As well as a uniform method for calculating attendance records. And as Mr. Swanson said, we've identified $600,000 in overpayments already since July 1 using these new tools. I'd also call, there's a little note over on the right-hand side about record reviews. One of the challenges that our investigators have when they get a tip of something, go out to a provider, is the first thing they do is gather up a bunch of attendance records, usually paper records. They have to go through those and then try to align them with what was billed. It's a very challenging process to go through. We worked and built a tool that actually streamlines that somewhat, that's allowed our providers to be able to take that provider or that attendance data, enter it in, and do a pretty quick comparison to what we're seeing in our MEC squared records for what was billed. And you'll see there that we did this with 46 providers since July 1 and reviewed over 100,000 records using that new tool. So it just speeds up that process that is inevitably a challenging part of doing these investigations. The second bucket, administrative sanctions, this is also an area where there are a number of pieces that were strengthened. Particularly increasing the penalties for program violations and clarifying our authority about when we can use those tools. And as Mr. Swanson said, we've done a number of disqualifications and closed and terminated centers from the program already based on these tools. A big piece of this was under the old law, when we were doing a disqualification, it was kind of a three strikes and you're out. First time was 1 year, second time was 3 years, third time was permanent. Now we're at 3 years for the first time and permanent on the second. And we think for when we're to the point of disqualification and seeing a more serious set of violations, that that's a far more appropriate way to address those issues. We also moved the standard of evidence to preponderance of evidence, which aligns to the standard for administrative actions in our other programs in the program integrity area, such as our medical assistance programs. And that also helps in terms of ensuring that we can stand up cases through the administrative process and move appropriately with actions against providers when we've seen irregularities and misuse of funds. So those were the main pieces in that area that really helped us to strengthen the work on the sanctions. Provider oversight is a key issue in this, and it was one that was particularly called up by the legislative auditor as to how we are providing oversight and ensuring that we are have eyes on centers often enough to ensure that they are actually operating as a center, there are kids there, there is care being provided consistent with what's being billed. Mr. Swanson really references and talked about it. It's that upper left-hand corner of the green, that early and often team. You provided us with 10 FTEs that we combined with some existing staff, licensing, fraud, data analysts, who work together and are going out to centers, first of all, new centers which within their first 12 weeks. We often find that new centers struggle, so setting aside fraud, just struggle to sort of figure out how to get themselves set up, make sure they're complying with licensing, and also manage the billing side, which is a complicated part of working with the child care assistance program. So they go out to every center, a new center that opens in the first 12 weeks. That really puts us in a much better position to not be worrying that somewhere out there is a center that is billing us that is really just an empty warehouse with no kids and the kind of stories we've heard, because we're out there in the first 12 weeks and seeing what's going on. In addition, this group will visit centers where we're seeing other kinds of challenges. For example, lots of billing errors, potential signs of fraud, serious noncompliance with licensing rules. And by putting licensing and the fraud folks together, we put both baskets of tools together. The tools that we have on the fraud program integrity side, but also the tools that licensing has to suspend licenses and to do, take other actions when we see really that there might be real risk to children in that care. So I think this really gets at getting ahead of the issue and not being in a position where we might find out 18 months into a center's history there are problems, spend another 2 years investigating it, and all that money goes out the door in the meantime and is not going to the children and the families in Minnesota that really need it. So it's really trying to get us out of the pay and chase mode and into being upfront and identifying issues early. And also, where necessary, just supporting new providers who are just struggling to get their center to align to the licensing standards and to get their billing right by being out there early and being able to give them technical assistance, not even when there's fraud, just trying to put them in a good position to provide good care in a compliant way with all the laws that we put in place. We also came forward last year and recommended, as did the legislative auditor, that we look at electronic attendance billing. There are methods other states that are using that provide more integrity in the attendance side, allowing ways to ensure that what is being billed is actually based on kids that attended on a given day. And many centers are already using electronic billing. This would essentially move us toward potentially creating that as a system-wide requirement for some portion of providers. What we asked for last year was an FTE to help us start developing that. Significant consultation needed to do this with counties, with providers, with the communities who are affected, learning from other states and what they've done. And so we've started that process, met with stakeholders, met with the county, surveyed providers. We will come back to the 2021 legislature with some additional recommendations on how we move in that direction after we've been able to work with stakeholders and gather that input. And then finally, we made a lot of changes to the ownership provisions in the licensing statutes. Ownership provisions are what we look at when we're deciding whether or not to license a new program and understanding who's really owned the program, who are really the people who are responsible for what goes on in that program, and giving us a few more tools to dig in and understand who those folks are so that as best we can, we're trying to identify where there might be bad actors who are trying to get into the child care business. Nothing is foolproof because everybody can always hide a name, but it gives us some more tools and some actionable after the fact if something was hidden. Law enforcement collaboration, you provided two additional BCA agents who work on the investigation side for criminal cases when we refer them to the BCA. Those are in process of being hired. And you also did a lot of work to clarify how we could share data. It was actually unclear how and when we could share data with law enforcement, which is obviously a fairly big barrier to doing this work. We were doing it, but we were concerned that it could be challengeable as to how we were doing it. So that was clarified. Sharing data with the Department of Education, who administers programs that cross over often with the same providers, same children, that was very helpful just to give us an ability to really execute investigations. And then finally, one of the issues that we talked a lot about last year is data analytics. And doing a better job of identifying issues using all the data that we have, whether it's licensing data, whether it's data through billing, whether it's data that we have from our background studies division. We have a lot of data available to us that we can use to identify where there might be a problem, where there might be a trend that we're seeing, where there might be a provider that has some irregularities. And we haven't been executing on that as well as we should. As Mr. Swanson mentioned, this is built in directly into our continuous improvement process, very data-driven process to try to ensure that we're making best use of that data. So we really built a more robust data team. It's still in its infancy. We're working forward, figuring out how to work together to use the data as best we can. But we do think that that's going to be, going forward, one of the key ways in which we're able to, again, do that early identification and avoid that situation where there might be a provider that is doing something irregular for a long period of time without us being able to detect it. So, Mr. Chair, that's a quick summary of the laws that were passed last year, where we're at with implementation. I didn't talk about effective dates. Most of these things were effective July 1 of last year and are in place and in process now. Except for the few that we're working on as sort of ongoing projects like the electronic attendance records.
Excellent. Thank you. That's a really impressive set of work. So I'm going to go back to Representative Heintzman to let him finish anything he wants to now, and we can serve back to you as well, and then we'll have Representative Franson coming after that. Representative Heintzman, anything more? Yeah, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner Johnson. One of the comments you made in your opening statement was it's really important that we have strong program integrity, which, of course, we all agree. Director Swanson said we had a real lack of standards and protocols, and I'm assuming we're talking about previous years. And I'm also assuming that it led to verifiable fraud. Why is it that we had to go through what we've gone through the last few years, Commissioner Johnson, to get to this point where we can finally recognize, as legislators, Republicans, have been saying for a long time, there is fraud in this program, and we're being, it felt like, stonewalled time and time again when we're saying this has got to be fixed. Why did it take this much pressure to get to the point where we can admit we had a real lack of standards and protocols?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair and Representative Heintzman, that's a good question. I think that we were aware of the fraud and working to address the fraud since 2013. We came to the legislature in 2013 to get the authority to essentially create DHS as the entity that's responsible for identifying, investigating program integrity in the child care assistance program. We came in 2017 and asked for additional investigators, which were provided. Because working with our investigative team at the time, they said this problem is bigger than we can manage with the staff that we have, and we added more staff. I think what we were missing is that adding more staff wasn't actually solving the problem because of this process. And because we had a process that very well-intentioned people were very passionate about trying to identify and address where there was fraud in the system, I think the legislative auditor said it, the manager of the unit said it to me directly in 2018, we can't investigate our way out of this problem. We need to have some of the tools that you see over here as part of this process. Certainly, from our perspective, we should have figured that out earlier. I would acknowledge that. It would have been nice if we had that sit down and understood where this process was failing us before we got into 2018 and into 2019. That probably would have put us in a better position to have not had some of the challenges that we saw ongoing. But I think that at the time, both we and the investigators felt as we were going through that period of time that we were doing a pretty good job. We put a number of cases that we brought to the court that we had convictions on, that we got restitution on, or got charged restitution, where we had to recover is always a separate issue. And that seemed to be working. I think it was only as we saw the escalation of the issue through into 2017, into 2018, that we realized that it wasn't, we weren't going to just be able to hire enough investigators. We needed to really think about how we provided that upfront oversight, ongoing process that does a better job of identifying those problems earlier, so we're not in the position of trying to do a pay and chase and a big criminal investigation that might take 2 or 3 years to execute on. And in some cases, it's still going to be really darn hard to prove, as the legislative auditor said, because of the challenge of trying to align those records and get to the criminal standard, which, of course, is beyond a reasonable doubt. So these administrative tools that were adopted last year, which we had, but they weren't as strong and weren't as clear as where our authority was, puts us in a much better position to be able to address those issues early. The resources you gave us in that front end, that green box up there, help us be in a position to get out early, see providers, put additional oversight on those providers where we see challenges, and be able to address those issues. And so I think we're in a better place than we were. It's unfortunate it took us the length of time it did to get here and some of the pain that went on over the last couple of years to do it. But I think now we're on the right track going forward with the new process we have in place and with the legislative changes from last year.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Representative Heitzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Commissioner Johnson, since we have you here today, and I don't know when we might have another opportunity to speak, we did, as you highlighted, make a number of legislative tools available to you. Is there anything off the top of your head that we didn't do that you think that we need to do?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, the one issue that we brought forward last year that didn't get passed was anti-kickback legislation. And this essentially, most of the schemes that we look at within child care fraud, and honestly in some of our health care programs too, are kickbacks, often between the participants and the provider, going one direction or the other depending on what the relationship is. And that would be another tool to help, particularly on the criminal side. We'd actually made good changes that went through the House Judiciary. There was a lot of input in that committee, and so we really improved the language we started with. But we were unable to get the Senate to agree at the end of session to move that language. So we would hope to be able to do that this year.
I do want to clarify that anti-kickback language did pass the House, but then was stopped. And it did not advance in the Senate and then was stopped in conference. And I think we'll be advancing it again this session, we expect to. Representative Heisman, anything else right now?
I might have some more questions, Mr.
Understood. Yeah, we'll circle back to you. Representative Franson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I want to thank both Commissioner Johnson and Mr. Swanson for being here today, and the Chair for having this being as our number one meeting of the 2020 session. You know, back in the district and around the state, this is probably one of the biggest topics is the Department of Human Services. I also bartend and wait tables part-time, and every time I work, which is a whopping 2 days a week. But anyway, this is the number one topic people are asking about. Every time there's a new story, it's what are you doing about DHS? What is being done about DHS? So I'm actually optimistic that we are, as a body, seriously digging into this issue. So thank you. I did find the testimony. I have found the testimony so far fascinating that there is an admittance that there was lots of fraud. It sounds like, yes, you guys said, yep, there's a lots of fraud. It's real. We don't have enough investigators. Did I hear that correct at the time when you were seeing, like, all this fraud?
Commissioner or Mr. Swanson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Franson, I wouldn't make that statement as to where we are currently, because I think with the current process,
previous,
we're ahead of it more, and you added some staff. But as Mr. Swanson will tell you, anytime we put a new process in place, one of the tests you find out after the first year or maybe a little bit longer is, do we actually need more staff to make this work right too? So that might be a question that we'll come back with at some point after we've gotten further into this process.
Right, but I'm talking about previously.
That's correct, previously.
Okay, thank you. So this is something that I know my side of the aisle has been saying. There's lots of fraud in the program. We have to get to the fraud. Yet the public itself was gaslighted into believing there wasn't lots of fraud. Republicans were exaggerating the number of fraud cases, exaggerating the dollar amount of fraud, and we were saying, no, it's real, yet we heard from the department, we heard that it wasn't as much. No, we had the numbers of the thousands of dollars in fraud here. This was so anyway, I'm glad that we're moving forward. New process. I'm excited. You know, I don't like to judge something before it's had an effect to work. But thank you for that. And then also, is it possible for the body to get a list of the two terminations that were mentioned, also the two closures and the four administrative disqualifications, so we can kind of gauge a look at those centers and just see kind of what was written up before, what led to those, so we can have a good picture of that as well. And then finally, Mr. Swanson, your testimony had a lot of numbers and data that was provided. Is it possible that we could get a copy of that testimony?
So a couple questions there, I think. So whoever wants to take whichever part first, Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, okay. To your question about the names of the providers, I'd have to go back and talk to our attorneys about what the status of those is and what's public or not public. But certainly whatever is public, we can provide to you.
Please do.
On those. As far as Mr. Swanson's notes, we can provide you with the numbers that Mr. Swanson shared.
Maybe I can just clarify, too, that you'd referenced the number $600,000 in overpayments. I believe that that would necessarily have been looking back over several years as well, as opposed to just during the 7 months I think that was referenced. Is that correct, if anybody can clarify
that's
that?
That's right, Mr. Chair. Those are payments that we identified during the seven-month period we're talking about. Some of them may have actually been based on circumstances that happened going back a couple of years. So the $600,000 is kind of an odd starting number that represents a certain amount of backlog, a certain amount of new activity. It's not necessarily a good number to help us understand what that scope looks like going forward. That's why we need more time to sort of have this process work through and see what that actually looks like.
Because it's sort of like now that you have this clearer process, kind of a better lens, you can look backwards and see things you might not have been able to see under the legacy process, which is why that potentially could be a bigger number than it would be going forward, because it's encompassing multiple.
Well, Mr. Chair, we have data. I think that, you know, we just didn't have good data before.
Right.
And that was on us. That was something we identified as we started to dig and try to understand the issues. It's like, wow, we need to have a more consistent way of tracking these things. And so the benefit here, as Mr. Swanson said, is we'll be able to provide you with these numbers going forward on a regular basis as to what the status is.
Good. Thank you. And then back to Representative Franson.
Thank you. Final question, unless there's something more exciting that jumps up.
No problem.
But can you just remind the committee who is currently managing the OIG, and when do you expect a permanent IG to be named?
Commissioner.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Franson, we had a interim in place, Bob Jacobson, who was former law enforcement officer, retired through January, but he left. He was only intending to be part-time, and he needed to go back to being retired and being with his family. So Kalani Moti, who serves normally as the lead counsel for the OIG, is serving as an acting in that role right now, reporting to me. We're in the process of hiring. That position was posted. The posting is closed. We're starting interviews next week for a permanent inspector general.
Okay. Anything else, Representative Franson, right now?
No.
Okay. Representative, I guess I've got Representative Bonner, and then Representative Damath, you had a question? Okay. Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Commissioner Johnson, for being here today, as well as Director Swanson. I really appreciate that. First, I can tell you, as someone who has read a lot of these diagrams for a living, it is very clear that you had some very good practitioners. And I think you said you used Lean Six Sigma, is that?
Correct.
Yep. Which, for those of you who do not know, is a very intensive, deep dive process into looking at how you find efficiencies, capitalizing on lessons learned, looking at how people work through their process. It's been used more famously in things like, I believe it was Toyota, was it not?
Toyota Production System, correct.
Yes, which led to them outpacing all the other auto manufacturers for quite some time because of their intensive processes and improvements. So just to let people have that background. One of the things that I want to say is I think that I do have a couple questions in here, too. Thank you for incorporating the lessons learned so deeply into this process. And I know that a big value of having that data, as you mentioned, Commissioner Johnson, is having those clear metrics, metrics that are measurable, that are consistent, and that they're sustainable. And I think that that can definitely help us get a more clear picture, particularly moving forward, and I'm really grateful for that. But the other piece of that, of course, is that not only does it remove the silos so that we can have better communication amongst organizations and agencies so we can act on that data, but in the end, it also gives us much better outcomes in terms of being able to take quick, swift action, prevent further losses, resolving cases more quickly, and of course, more consistently, which is, I think, really key. So thank you for all of that. The one question I had is, so you mentioned earlier, Director, that you had a caseload initially of 1.5 cases. Can you tell us what that factor is now?
Sure. Mr. Swanson, I think he did give it.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative, it's 8.8, and that's a 450% increase.
And I forgot you had a fellow process improvement expert slash nerd, if I may say that.
I feel like we have a link
on the committee as well. Yes, we've got kindred spirit here.
Yeah.
Thank you. Representative Bonner, something else quick?
Thank you. That is incredibly helpful. And then I also had the question about the time frame used for the 600K, but I think we've already clarified that question. And I'm curious, do you have a metric that talks about the amount of time that you're seeing cases resolve from start to completion? Or is that a metric that you are tracking right now? I'm not sure.
Sure. Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, as Deputy Commissioner Johnson said, we were really lacking in any data, operational data as well as strategic data. So for our daily management and just for managing the unit, believe it or not, we really didn't have a caseload tracking for individuals. So we have that now. We are going to work on that muscle memory for accuracy, as you know, which is so important. And then speed will come naturally as the process is followed. But I have a good guess, but you know, you're never supposed to let those go. But I think we are going to hit some really impressive numbers with defect-free investigations. So we're excited about it.
Thank you, Mr. Swanson. Thank you, Representative. Yeah. Representative Damuth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you both for your testimony today. Director Swanson, you had mentioned that since July there's been 63 investigations and 23 warning letters for minor violations.
I believe 20 warning letters.
Okay, 20. Yep. My mistake, 20 warning letters.
Yeah, for minor infractions.
Were the 20 warning letters any part of the 63 investigations? Are those over and above? And then what happens after? Why are we sending warning letters?
Mr. Swanson.
I believe, and I'll have to get back to you specifically, but I believe the 20 warning letters was in response to the information during that time frame, so the investigations, but we'll get back with clarification on that. Second part of your question?
Second part of the question, what are we giving warnings out for?
Mr. Swanson.
Because we focus, I believe they're called minor infractions or minor policy infractions. Go ahead.
I see, Mr. Chair, and Representative, they're largely irregularities in attendance records that don't reach the level of triggering an investigation from a fraud perspective, but are sort of in line with, we're seeing something here that we think is a concern, and here's a warning letter. And once you get a warning letter, it triggers us the next time we see some irregularities, we will move to an investigation. So that's the purpose of it. It is to put the provider on notice that we've seen some issues.
Thank you.
Okay, and if there's a little bit, it sounds like there may be some follow-up there to send. I'm going to jump to Representative Franson, and we'll do that, and then I've got Representative West on the list, and Representative Pryor as well, but I want to make sure to give ample time to the minority. So Representative Franson.
Thank you. I was just thinking about this, something that I haven't asked before, surprising. I used to do child care, so the food program was part of the child care program. If you chose to participate in that. So if a provider is shut down for fraud reasons, is the food program alerted to that as well? Because if there's fraud happening on the CCAP side of it, it certainly is happening on the food program side of it.
Commissioner?
Representative Franson, that's a good question. I don't know what we do in terms of coordinating with the food program. So we can follow up on that. That's worth understanding how we ensure that the food program is being alerted when we're seeing some irregularities.
Please do get back to us on that. Yeah, thank you for the question. Representative West, and then we'll have Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering what constitutes a minor infraction, like for attendance, and you know, we don't want to. What would make it go straight to an investigation rather than a warning, or is there always a warning? Because you know, you don't want to give deliberate fraudsters warning when you're going to come after them that they need to, you know, doctor their records better. So, if you could give an example of what's minor that needs a warning and what would go directly to investigation.
Okay. Commissioner Orr, Mr. Swanson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, if it's something egregious, of course, that's where these first assessments, that triaging and second assessment, if there is any indication something's egregious that needs to quickly go down a path that follows a criminal path, that gets done automatically. There would have to be no prerequisite for a warning letter in that case.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I'd just add to that. I think that managing attendance records and billing for the child care assistance program is complicated. So there's an issue of just not doing a very good job of managing it versus, you know, trying to determine if there's intent or a pattern or a consistency to how it's being done. So that's kind of one threshold. I think the other one is, I think there is a dollar threshold. So, like, if the dollars are big enough, then we're going to forget the warning letter and jump right in and look at a more aggressive approach.
And Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the very concise presentation this morning. It was actually, even with the microphone issue, it was easy to follow and just a nice visual display. So I do have two questions, and I'll try not to go too long. The first question is, you know, we do also hear the legislature is always talking about overregulation. And that a lot of that regulation does come from statute. And so we're always telling our providers, like, you know, do this, and this. And then they come back to us and say, we're overregulated. You know, you're going to put us out of business because of all these regulations. But then we also know that, you know, regulations are about accountability. It's to make sure that we're getting good care. We're getting, that there's integrity in the system. So, again, and to follow up on the question we already had from Representative Heitzman, is there something in this area that we should, again, take responsibility for in terms of regulations that are not adding, you know, in the lean world, where we're not adding value with the regulation? And, you know, maybe that's just something to come up at a later date and follow up on some of those ideas. And maybe if you have a response at this point, I'd appreciate it.
Commissioner or Mr. Swanson. Commissioner.
I just say, Mr. Chair and Representative Pryor, that's a very good point. And I think that balance of, you know, sort of when have we pushed too far and we're actually making it hard for providers to even, you know, open up a business and provide service and be able to manage it effectively versus ensuring that we have enough controls in place that we're making sure the money is actually going to kids and families that are supposed to get that money. And so we did some rebalancing last year, and we'll spend, you know, some time over sort of the next couple of years as we're implementing this, sort of getting a sense of what that right balance is. But I think certainly based on where we were last year, the steps we took last year were the right direction to be moving.
Thank you. That's all right. And Representative Pryor, right, I forgot.
One, yeah, all right. And thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then the other is... and this is, you do have the expertise for this that we don't, but could you put our program now where we are in a context in the 50 states? You know, are we still struggling and other states have got this down cold, or is this an issue in this area across the country?
Mr. Swanson, if you're or Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, and Representative Pryor, I don't have real detailed knowledge. I know a lot of states have struggled over the course of the time that we first identified this in about 2012 and came to you in 2013, that the fraud within this program is a challenge, and the particular kinds of schemes that we saw and have seen are similar to ones that other states have experienced. And so other states have gone through similar processes that we've gone through. A place that I mentioned earlier where I know some states are ahead of us on this is the electronic attendance record, which is really a tool that just builds in much more integrity in that really key issue of ensuring the attendance records are accurate as to what is actually getting billed. And so I think that's the place where we have some ability to improve and catch up with where a few other states are.
President Pryor, one comparison that I'm finding especially useful is actually inside the state. The commissioner mentioned Mr. Swanson's team working with the MDH health facilities complaints. I think it was that office. But you remember there was that big backlog. And just I guess I feel some confidence here and feel heartened by the fact that, we haven't had that. I mean, that backlog went down. Your team went in, done the work, and that's great. And so you presumably are able to apply some of that knowledge and work then to this process and this pretty impressive change in these. So that, I guess, back to Representative Heitzman's initial question about the confidence of this, that we know that's worked. Mr. Swanson, you want to add something?
Mr. Chair, Representative Pryor, just to give you a little follow-up to the Deputy Commissioner's response as well. We had this validated. Part of a design Six Sigma project is we had this validated with the Department of Revenue, who also does investigative type of work, Department of Commerce, and also our friends in the FBI. So we had it validated. So we feel very good that it encompasses best practices for sure. And I would hold this process up against a lot of them.
Thank you. Vice Chair Representative Katisa-Witoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As we were talking about the minor infractions earlier, one thing that came to my mind was on the licensing side of things, we have introduced the fix-it ticket. And so I was just wondering if that was a possible comparison. So somebody who's going through a licensing issue and there's just something small that they can take care of and then alert their inspector that problem is now gone. Since we don't have an actual list of the minor infractions, would that be comparable?
Mr. Swanson, or Commissioner.
And Representative, yeah, that's very comparable to what the warning letter serves as kind of a first step toward, hey, there's a problem here. And I think with the fix-it tickets, there's also a requirement that it gets fixed within 48 hours. And so it's kind of a, we saw this, you saw it, it's easy to fix, let's go ahead and move with it. And I think the warning letter is similar. It's just kind of to say, we saw something here. We're concerned about it. You're on notice. When we come back and look at your records the next time, we need to see them cleaned up and working the way it's supposed to. I think that's a good analogy. And I think there's talk within the licensing world of even going further in terms of tiering how we do with different types of violations. I don't know that in the program integrity area where we're most concerned about ensuring dollars are going, whether that would exactly be, we'd want to go quite that far. But similar concept that we're out there both to try to identify where there are issues that are fixable, that were just mistakes, and also try to identify where there's something more serious going on.
Okay. Thank you.
All right, Representative Franson.
Thank you. Yeah. I just remembered this too. So listening to your process, your new process, the Australia, same sort of issue, child care fraud, just in another area of our world. And the government said, this is just awful, and really cracked down on it, and actually is very proud of the fact that they have cut down on the fraud and prosecuted fraudsters. And it's the same operation that the fraudsters use here in Minnesota. You look at Australia, and you're like, oh my gosh, I'm reading this case, and this is exactly what's happening in Minnesota. So I would just implore you that if you have questions, like maybe some tweaks, if you think just to reach out to their government who has taken this issue and it seems to be working for them, just as a, somebody that's already paved the path forward on this as well.
I'm not sure Representative Franson is actually endorsing that your budget to fly to Australia.
No, not at
clear,
all. Email works.
Vivian must buy, exactly. You're not spending taxpayer dollars on that trip to Australia. Representative Franson does not want that. Any comment on that, gentlemen? Certainly comparing to other places, not just around the country, but around the world, seems like a good idea. Mr. Swanson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Franson, I think that's the one part of this Plan, Do, Study, Act process that you see on the right side of this handout. As you can see where we've originally done our first step in the improvement, and then we build upon that. So this would be very logical, whether we email Australia or we look at other things setting or look at data, we're going to constantly be looking at ways to improve this process moving forward. And this is very much a collaborative effort. This is not my team going in and say, do this, do this, do this. We're there to shepherd and mentor, but it's a collaborative effort of all the great staff in the OIG that has really turned this around. They've turned it around.
Yeah. Other questions from members or comments at this point? And seeing none, I'm just going to note that, and I appreciate the comments from Representative Heitzman and Franson and noting kind of us starting off with this, because this did seem to me to be a really important thing to start with. I think, as members are aware, and we're going to talk more next week, it's certainly the certainly my intent to advance through our body significant investments in early care and learning, and it's important that we recognize that along the way that we have sound processes, and so it was important to me that we get to hear about this as well. So with that, I will thank everyone for your time today, and then we'll, as I say, we'll be sending out information about next week, the next day or so. But please continue to be in touch. With that, we are adjourned.